Access number 27244, Mr. John Lincoln, Reel 10. Now, we've come to the end of your posting in Germany about 1971.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens next? You could presumably come back to England.
Yes, I was posted back to Chester. To Satan Camp, Chester. Satan Camp, Chester. It was the Army Rehabilitation Centre.
And what part of that unit were you?
Well, there was also Number 6 Dental Group was in there. And I was promoted to Staff Sergeant on posting.
So you were a Staff Sergeant Administrator?
Yep. I was Tech Stores. I was the stores person, medical stores for the dental group. Company Quartermaster Sergeant, CQMS, Staff Sergeant.
And it was number
6 Dental Group. Handled the whole of West Midlands and Wales, was the area it covered, and it was based at Chester. As far north as Preston, and as far south as Brecon.
That's a fair amount to cover.
Oh, yeah. There were big areas these groups covered. Well, it's money saving. Administered from one place, and just a dentist and a locally enlisted civilian actually on site somewhere, here, there, and everywhere, you know.
Now, what were your duties as, Staff Sergeant in charge of the medical stores, what did that usual sort of thing, just a higher grade?
It's a higher grade, complete control of the stores, accounting for the stores, and distribution of the stores.
But who did you, what was your staff? I mean, presumably you had people to help you with it.
Two private soldiers, yes.
And anything, no medical side at all, and pure admin?
Pure administration. Administration and supply.
And tell us a bit about your duties, as you remember, or anything about that camp. 71.
Yeah, we had a couple of Land Rovers, which we used to go out and about in, visiting the units, down into Wales, across the West Midlands. It was just mundane, you know. You just went on with it. The only highlight of that particular time I spent there, and I was there for 3 years, was that I did my warrant officer's course.
Now, what was a warrant officer's course?
Well, that's the biggie. It's 8 weeks, and that is the senior management course. And you went again to the RDMC training centre, and you do all the aspects, which included a couple of weeks at Purbright doing your drill for a regimental sergeant major. That was fun. That was fun. And you go to, it's an all arms drill course, and you've got all sorts. I mean, there was catering corps, medical corps, dental corps, every corps under the sun. And you go for this drill course to Purbright, and you're assigned Sergeant Major, the Guards Sergeant Major, and they take you through all the system of the gentle art of foot drill, and it's very, very good, highly amusing.
Did you enjoy that?
Oh yeah, it was highly amusing.
Was you drill up to spec? You know.
Yes. I mean, we all did generalized drill, but that's the specialized stuff, parade drill. You know, and you go there, and they really teach you all the nitty gritty of how to do ceremonial drill, which is what you need as a warrant officer, potentially a regimental sergeant major, you see. And
now, what else was part of this warrant officer's drill? What else, really, the big sections of it?
Big sections, you did fieldcraft, which is all the aspects of life in the field and the running thereof of field training camps. You do a big armaments session where you do nuclear warfare, you know, gas drills and so on and so forth. And, of course, the ranges and all the aspects of running a range for a unit. etc., etc. It's all that side of things. The purely military stuff that you do is a warrant on the warrant officer's course.
And you enjoy that side of stuff?
Oh, yeah, it's lovely. I really enjoy it.
Were you ever tempted to sort of switch right out into that side of thing, you know, into the away from the Royal Dental Corps? You could have done.
I could have done, yeah. Well, eventually I did because I went on the long service list.
Fair enough. Well, let's come back to that then. So you took this course, passed it.
Yes, and was promoted Regimental Quartermaster Sergeant, WO2. And went to the, back to Aldershot, would you believe? Back to Aldershot at the training centre.
Now, were you promoted before you got there? I mean,
you're promoted on posting. You appear in the new unit with the new badges. That's the way the system works.
So you were RQMS back at base?
Yes. And I ran the central stores complete. I was the boss now. Central quartermaster stores for the training centre.
And what do you remember of that? That was, what, 74?
Yeah, 74. I was there until 77.
Now, what do you remember about that job? That's now becoming a really big management.
It's a big management job, yes. No, I burnt the midnight oil on that on many occasions. It was hard work because you were running a whole hospital. The training centre now had become two parts. It had become a dental hospital with all the aspects of a hospital and also a training unit. So you had the two aspects and it was hard work. I had a staff of four, five in my quartermaster's department and no quartermaster, there was no officer, just me. So I was, in point of fact, doing an officer's job. And as I say, it was hard work, but it was very rewarding.
In what way?
I learned a lot. I did a lot on the accounting side of things, with accounts, etc. And that's always good knowledge to have, because you have to do the monetary side of things as well, you see. So I had a budget which I had to run, and of course I had to do the accounting accordingly. I had a very, very good corporal, who was a bright lad, and between us we ran. Eventually he became a regimental sergeant major, would you believe, Taffy. But he was a bright lad and he did the accounting side of things, and you know, we ran the account between us, the actual monetary side of things, doing the budget, etc., because we had to order up everything from the dental companies, you see. It's direct contact now with the outside world, outside of the army, not just going through an army stores depot. You dealt with the civilian companies outside, and that of course is big time, you know. And we did had to do the dental estimates for the whole corps.
How did you find the civilian contractors as compared to the, I mean, before you'd always been dealing with army people. I mean, how did it cope dealing with the world, the civilians? Well, you know.
Must I tell you that?
Yes. No, you don't have to.
Well, I won't be rude, but boy, talk about army fiddles. Wow. The civilian companies are the world's worst.
In what way? What sort of, so they were fiddling, basically.
Well, I don't know if they were fiddling or not. I mean, it was none of my business, you know what I mean? But it's a different world, completely different world.
What sort of problems did you encounter with them?
Supply. They'll promise you things and you never got them. You know, and you can't run like that. When you have the number of personnel we were dealing with, you had to have the supplies when you wanted them, not when they felt like it. I mean, I had a to-follow system, which was ginormous. I was up to 2 years out of time with items to follow from these companies because they couldn't supply them. Or they'd take your order because they were getting good money from the military. MOD money is good.
Were they paid up front? Or?
As far as I know, yes.
So they get paid before they delivered stuff?
Yeah, they get paid for a contract. And of course they did not fulfil the contract.
And it was your job to pursue this?
Yes. I have some very acrimonious sessions with some of them. But we got there in the end. But that side of things I didn't enjoy at all, because you were constantly chasing these people. They would not supply when you wanted them to. There was always some excuse, you know. Well, I think in many cases a lot of them were overstretched.
Now, anything else about that time at back at Aldershot?
Not really. It was quite a quiet time.
So what's your next? So that's till 77. Another 3 years there?
Yes, well, I was then promoted to the big job. Warrant Officer Class 1, Regimental Sergeant Major. Or, as we called it in the Corps, Administrative Warrant Officer. That's almost, you're a non-commissioned commission, if you like. And I was sent to Scotland, to Edinburgh, here, to the castle.
Now, who were you joining there?
I was joining Headquarters Scotland. Army Headquarters Scotland. And I was responsible for the whole of the dental service for Scotland and the Outer Islands.
The Army Dental Service?
Yes. Well, it's joint services. We were interchangeable. I had RAF people and Navy people on the fringes.
Now, that sounds like a... was there an officer in charge of the dental service as well, and you were his?
Oh yes, there was a colonel.
So what was the composition of the dental service?
Well, you had a director of dental services who was a colonel, who lived in Craigie Hall, which was the headquarters of Scotland, and you had me. I was the administrative warrant officer, the regimental sergeant major, if you like, of the dental service and supply for Scotland, and I had a team of 8. And I worked together with my opposite number, who was the RAMC side of things, because they had a similar sort of setup. And what we did, we worked half with the military and half with the civilians, because a lot of the areas in Scotland which have military personnel on training staffs, like cadet training teams, outward bound schools, all this sort of thing, Queen Victoria School, Dunblane, for instance, which is a huge military boarding school. All of these things have military personnel, but we didn't have medical dental staff to staff them. So what we would do is we put out a contract to the local National Health Service practitioner in the local town. And myself and my opposite number were responsible for making sure that these people didn't fiddle us. Because it was all done on a reciprocal agreement, National Health Service, and they claimed their money from the Army, from the service, from MOD, for doing MOD contract jobs for medical and dental treatment. And we had to go and we had to check all of their accounts and treatment schedules and all the things they'd done, etc., and make sure that they weren't telling us porkies, you know. And it was a very interesting job. So fast.
Were they ever telling porkies?
I'm not going to tell you. Well, let's put it this way. Some of them massage the truth. I think that's a lovely expression. They massage the truth. Usually on their side. The game was on their side. Because like every civilian organisation I've ever come in contact with when I was in the military, they always think the military is a soft touch. That we've got endless supplies of money, and it doesn't matter. They can tell you anything you like, and we'll just pay out of hand. But that is not so. The military are much, much sharper than that. And it was a very interesting job, as I say.
But so you were monitoring the contracted NHS dentist. What else were you doing? What other duties? I mean, you've got the army teams in the bigger barracks. I presume there were army
Oh, yes,
teams.
It was army teams in the bigger barracks. I had dental centres here, there and everywhere. I had one at Fort George, for instance. It's a fascinating place, you know. And I was responsible for their well-being and administering their lives, as one is when one is the senior manager.
And so these there were army dentals. Were there many of them?
I think we had Benbecula, which was the Rocket Rangers. We had Fort George. We had Aberdeen. We had Glasgow and Edinburgh itself. There was about 8, and of course the naval one at Rosyth. We had about 8 and an RAF one out on Bullaghore, out on the Hebrides. So we had more about 10 military units we administered, and the rest was contract.
Now, for the military ones, presumably you were less monitoring to make sure they weren't on fiddles, and more supplying. And
more supply and administration of the personnel. You run their lives, you see. All central documentation was done here in Edinburgh at the headquarters. And this was number 8 dental group, by the way. And you sort of run their lives, you know, make sure they've got their pay and leave and all that.
And any problems? What were the big problems you were encountering?
Not really. It was mostly keeping all the balls in the air, because money was starting to get tight through the MOD, and of course we the budgets were suffering and so on and so forth. It was all that sort of thing, which was the hard side of things. Because you see, you can't do anything without money, and I'm afraid the MOD have suffered the pinching of the purse for an awfully long time.
So, I mean, were you able to maintain services, or did you have to pass on the cuts?
No, we maintained a service. When I left them 3 years later, I mean, the service was very good.
But it took more juggling.
It took more juggling to keep all the balls in the air.
So you were there 77 to?
77 to 81.
So three, nearly 4 years.
Yeah.
Anything else about that time? You living in Edinburgh, were you? Or?
Yes, we lived inside Redford Barracks. We had a Marrick Quarter, obviously Marrick Quarter. Very nice one too. Big 3-bedroom house. And my children were at boarding school, of course. And we used to go backwards and forwards and pick them up and bring them home and so on and so forth. No, it was a very nice time. I really enjoyed my stay at Edinburgh Castle. The biggest hotel in Edinburgh.
So what next then? 81?
Well, at this time, I was coming towards the end of my contracted service with the Army, the 22-year point. And I applied to join the Families and Welfare Service, which is what is known as the Long Service List. There are many jobs within the Army, especially in the big garrisons, which are done by people who have fulfilled their 22-year contract and are taken on for an extra term of service to 55, which would give you what they call the full army life. In other words, you would retire from active life at 55, as you do in the police service, the fire service, all these other sort of things. This system works throughout the three services, and they're known as long service personnel. And you get all sorts of static jobs in garrisons. Well, one of the biggest static jobs in the Army is the Housing and Welfare Service, looking after the families, in other words. And this is the one I applied to join.
So is it Families and Welfare Service or Housing and Welfare Service?
Families and Welfare Service. It's
now, what happened when you applied?
Oh, I got several interviews with the Housing Welfare Services. And you go and you get interviewed and so forth. And they put your name forward to Central Clearing Records, of the long service list. You actually leave your corps, you see, and you go into the army on general service. You're in the big army outside, in other words. You're no longer in your corps or regiment. And I was put on this list to wait for a vacancy occurring. There are none of them in the UK. It's all a system that works outside in the garrisons around the world. And I was lucky enough, I got a vacancy, would you believe, in Paderborn, where I had served before. It's a lovely old medieval German city, you know. And I was sent there as what they call an estate warden, which is the post, and you're a member of the Army Families and Welfare Service.
Now, tell us about this job.
Very interesting job. I did a course at Exeter University in welfare counselling.
Now, tell us about that.
Well, you do it. You become a counsellor, the same as you have in Civvy Street, you know. You do all the aspects of family life and so on. And you look after the well-being of the families. They come to you for counselling. And you're a member of a team. Inside the garrison, you've always got the SAFA, the church, the army welfare, and the housing. And it's all worked as a team.
Now, I'm quite interested in how they trained you as a welfare counsellor.
Well, I went to Exeter University.
What skills were they, you know, were they trying to get into you?
Counselling. How to work, how to speak, talk to people, how to take on board their problems, how to advise them, how to channel their needs into one of the welfare services. And that's what you learn when you go to the university. And you become a member of the Institute of Welfare.
Did you have any problems sort of adapting to the sort of sympathy levels that you need in that job? You know, the fact you have to be, you can't just tell people to pull themselves together, I presume.
No, you can't.
Which is almost a natural urge for a long-serving NCO, I would have thought.
It is.
To be honest.
It is. Yes, you are tempted to say, move yourself, you know, but you can't do that. You have to sit and look at the case, and you confer with the rest of your team, the SAFA sister and the minister and so forth, and you come to a classic solution for that particular person. You can then advise them, pass them on to the medical service or whatever.
So tell me about the sort of cases what sort of cases are you dealing with? What are the prevalent problems in the army? We can guess at some of them, but can you run through the sort of, without names, the sort of, you know, I'm sure you wouldn't dream of giving us names, but the sort of problems that you encountered?
Well, marital problems is a biggie. Abuse within marriage, threatened divorce, abuse of the children, this sort of thing comes out quite hard. Then there's the other aspect, which is the homesickness.
Well, let's deal with marital problems. I mean, how would you deal with marital problems, the various forms of marital problems? What were the classic solutions?
Well, the classic solutions would be that you'd pass the case on to a judiciary in some form, you know, the Army Legal Service, and they advise the incumbents on how to go about, for instance, if it was a case of divorce or so on, and you work with your team. I mean, you interview these people, you do a case record, and then the case record is passed up the line to either the legal services or the medical service, according to what the situation is. And you are an assessor, if you like, of the situation. You see, each regiment has a family's officer. He's not trained. He's just the family's officer. He's the crying stool where they go with all their problems. If he can't handle it, he passes it on to the garrison headquarters, and that's where we used to come in, and would interview the family, the husband, the wife, together, separately. And, of course, you'd have the SAFA sister from the SAFA welfare services, who has contact outside, out with the army, to all things like the adoption agencies, homes for the aged, and all the rest of it. So the network is very big. But initially, you'd interview the person, they'd tell you they'd bring their problem to you via the FAMO, the family's office, and you'd then start working through the system. I mean, we had some extremely good churchmen who were on the teams, and they were very good value because they have a different aspect, if you like, being a churchman to what
these
you,
are the padres or whatever, chaplains.
The chaplains, yeah. They have a much different aspect on life than what me, the brutal licentious soldier, if you see what I mean. But you temper your decisions within your team before you then advise the people.
So there's the Padres and the SAFA, that's the Soldiers, Air Force.
The Soldiers, Air Force, it's the Soldiers, let's think of what it's called, the SAFA. Soldiers, Airmen, Families Advisory Service. It's purely welfare. And they deal with everything from adopting a child to burying somebody, you know. It's
and they had a counsellor on base that was that would liaise with you and the padre and the chaplains.
Oh, yeah. The Safa sister. There's always one in every barracks, every headquarters. And her job is to sit on the welfare board, if you like, and advise and put you in contact with the people who will deal with it.
Now, how did you take to this work?
I enjoyed it very much. I'm pretty much a people's person, always have been. And this aspect was, it was a different aspect of army life, if you like. You were now helping the soldier by looking after his family. If he can leave his family in safety and comfort behind, he will be a better soldier when he gets to the front. And that's what our job was of the garrison staff.
So you saw it as a serious part of helping to improve military efficiency by...
Exactly. I mean, we sent people away to the first Iraq war, for instance, almost entirely from Germany. We were rear echelon as far as that war was concerned. And they moved out and they left their families behind. They moved out to what was going to be an unknown quantity. As it happens, the butcher's bill was very small. Because basically, our friend Saddam Hussein ran away, didn't he?
So you were providing support to the families back
yeah,
home during the
very
Iraq
much
war.
So.
Were
very
there any particular
so.
Problems with them, or were they all right?
Well, of course, they were very worried because it was a modern technological war which could have turned out very nasty. If he'd had all these weapons he bragged about, our soldiers were going to face them firsthand. There still are problems caused by that war from the inoculations we had to give the troops against the fact that there was going to be chemical warfare. But that's another story and not really any of my business. But that, of course, is bordering on. And the families left behind were in a highly nervous state as to what was happening to their menfolk up the line. So our work was pretty well cut out, just sort of keeping the lid on everything, you know.
Now, when you mentioned homesickness, that was one of the problems that you had to deal with. Was that a serious problem?
Yes, it was. A soldier will go home on leave and he's got a girl, you know, the girl he left behind him, and he chats her along how wonderful it is to come and live in Germany and let's get married, and they have a big wedding and everybody's in uniform and white this and all of that. He comes back to Germany. The minute he gets there, he's got to go on duty up the border. Don't forget, we belonged to Paderborn Garrison, was the headquarters of the 33rd Armoured Battle Group, which were responsible for patrolling the fence, the border, between East and West Germany. That meant the troops that at that garrison were constantly on duty, going backwards and forwards for their patrols up and down the border. So, of course, he'd come home from UK to Germany, to the garrison, pop his wife in a Murray quarter and immediately go on 3 weeks duty up the border, leaving her behind. She didn't speak German. She was in a foreign land. She didn't know how to go on. She didn't know where anything was. The family's office of the regiment did their best, but of course, out on the Murray quarters estates, it's us that they come in contact with, the garrison welfare staff. So you had all of this going on all the time. And all the reason, well, I want to go home and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, you want to persuade them, well, you're home's here now sort of style. And look after them accordingly, which is what we did.